Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Mike Hudak. Thanks for being with us, Mike.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
Hey, Mike, we like to start the show by asking our guests what inspired them to get into animal protection and veganism. I'm wondering if you can share your path.
Yeah, it's kind of a long story going way back before I actually made any kind of a change in my diet, at least, not to mention other things. But I grew up in a family with a father who had a lot of health conditions, type 2 diabetes, atherosclerosis, and this started already back, when I was fairly young. I was only about 10 years old when he got type 2 diabetes, about 15 when he had his first heart bypass surgery. And, of course, back in those days, this was the 1960s, there wasn't a whole lot from the medical community about the connection between diet and these conditions. And so I sort of lived in constant fear for years that my father's fate would eventually become my own.
Mm-hmm.
And, wasn't until the late 70s that I had a couple of friends who sort of inadvertently influenced me. Okay, one guy was a friend of mine from the graduate school who then went to medical school, and he started to tell me already around 1979 or so that he was seeing things in the medical literature about connections between consumption of meat and atherosclerosis. And then I had another friend who was dating a guy from Cornell University, which is located in Ithaca, New York, where the fairly well-known Moosewood restaurant is located. And so they were eating there, and she showed me this cookbook that she'd gotten from them and so on. So putting those two things together and then my own investigation by 1980 persuaded me that I should give up at least meat. And dairy products, the influence of dairy products on health wasn't so well known at that time, but I did give up meat. And then a few years later, I acquired John Robbins' book, Diet for a Small America, or Diet
Planet.
For New America.
New America.
Diet
yeah.
for New America.
Yeah, New America.
And then became aware of the horrors of factory farming and those kinds of things. So I was still eating some dairy products, mostly under doctor's orders, actually, because I was being treated for an acne condition using antibiotics. And it was like, oh, you have to eat yogurt in order to counteract the bad effects of the antibiotics on intestinal flora.
Uh-huh.
So, and I tell you, getting non-dairy yogurt in the 1980s. And so that went on a few more years. But then I attended my first vegan conference in 1991. And I also attended one of the summer fests at that time, too. And after that, I became vegan in diet and as much as possible in everything else I use as well.
Yeah.
Well, so that sounds like an interesting path. So how did you go from being a math and computer science major into studying grazing in the arid Southwest?
Yeah, well, that was another part of my education, so to speak. I spent 5 years working for a multinational high-tech company, specifically Siemens. It's on my website, I think, and was fully immersed in corporate politics with a small p. I'm not talking about influencing elected officials or anything else, but just what goes on in a corporation like that. And became thoroughly disgusted with that. And also I saw the field that I was working in at the time, which was artificial neural systems, not going anywhere after I'd been working in it really for 10 years, both for my doctorate and then in industry. I didn't see this going anywhere in my sort of professional lifetime. And so it was either like get out of that then after 5 years or so and maybe go into management, which of course I didn't want to do because of all the politics, or switch the field technically, which I didn't really see as all that feasible. So I really dropped out of the company. I dropped out of society and investigated a whole bunch of things that I might do, including becoming a Buddhist monk or sort of a back-to-the-land farmer. And none of those things really worked out for me. And so I was doing some hiking, actually quite a bit of hiking during the summers out in the West. I saw a lot of impacts of the ranching on the public lands, even in wilderness areas. And I wasn't really thinking, though, about environmental education as something that I would do. But eventually I did start to think about that after 2 years or so. And, of course, the issue of the day, mid-1990s, particularly in the Sierra Club, was that of logging on public lands. And I thought, well, instead of just going out to these places in the West to hike, I'll sort of hike with a purpose. And that purpose initially became to see where these timber cuts and proposed timber cuts were, and to talk with the activists who were involved in some cases, trying to postpone or stop these timber cuts. And I took pictures of all of these things, and then I came back east and was doing some shows about them. And at one of the shows to a private forest owners association, one of the people in the audience asked me what the Sierra Club was doing about the grazing on the public lands, because they were a little worried that the Sierra Club was just focusing on forests, and even though they were just focusing on public forests, at that time they might come after the private forest owners at some point, which was the interest of these people. And so it was actually kind of a snide remark, like, you know, why are you just focusing on the forests? So what were they doing about the grazing? And actually, I hadn't looked at the Sierra Club policy at that point, even though I'd seen a lot of the impacts in the West. So I did look at the policy, and it was something that I thought could have been written by the livestock industry. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, you know, maybe this is something I should look at in addition to promoting the forest issues. And so the next year, beginning in 1997, I started visiting grazing allotments and talking with grazing activists in the West, taking a lot of pictures, and put together a show about that.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you saw when you were hiking in these grazed lands in the West?
Yeah, because I think it's hard for many of us, and especially a lot of environmentalists, they don't really see the impact that commercial livestock grazing has on public lands and general land in general. But what were the impacts?
Well, I mean, there were some were more obvious than others, but I mean, the most obvious ones were the cow pies all over the place, particularly near sources of water. And then, of course, there'd be streams that were trampled. Some of the stream damage was certainly, a lot of it was long-term damage, not just something done from that season, but damage that had occurred over several decades that wasn't immediately apparent to me, because I didn't know what those streams had originally looked like, maybe 80 years earlier. And I did learn, after not very long, that those streams should have been fairly deep and narrow rather than wide and shallow. And that's typically the way the streams I saw all looked. And, of course, that's very bad for the aquatic life, for the fish and the invertebrates and everything else associated with those streams. So that was another thing. Then, of course, there's impacts on forests. I also learned that the cattle grazing can affect the incidence and severity of fire in forests. That had been studied already in the late 1940s, and so that was another factor that I've pointed out in my shows at that time. So those are just a few of the things. Of course, then there's also the incidence of the changes in the vegetative composition of these areas, too, because there's certain plants, particularly perennial plants, that the cattle like to eat, and that opens up a niche for weedy species of annual grass, such as cheatgrass, for instance, but many others, that have much less nutrient for native wildlife. And, of course, something like cheatgrass also contributes to more frequent fires as well. So those were the kinds of impacts that I saw.
Well, you know, it seems like now I think many more people are making that connection with the environmental impacts of, you know, meat-based diets and also thinking about other countries where we're clear-cutting forests in order to either grow soybean to feed to livestock animals, or to actually have the animals graze on that land efforts. Deforested And it seems like now, as people are becoming educated, now the ranching community is coming back and trying to find ways to justify continuing this status quo of how they've raised cattle for so long, despite all the impacts. You just came out recently, not too long ago, with an article about this, and maybe we can speak a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah.
So why did you set out to write this article in the first place?
Right. Well, there's two things here. There's the article, and then there's a video that I made based on the article. The purpose for writing the article is different for the purpose from the purpose of making the video. So you have to go back to early 2015, and I got a message from my friend Todd Schumann, who was on the Sierra Club's grazing team. And what was going on in the Sierra Club at that time is that the club was revising its agricultural policy, and there were people on the team working on the policy proposal who were big advocates for using animals, particularly cattle, for what's called regenerative agriculture. In other words, it would be the use of cattle to enhance the nutritive value of the soil upon which they're grazing. And so apparently these people had produced several peer-reviewed articles in support of their contention. And Todd was, in effect, handing out assignments to people on the grazing team, of giving them, you know, here's an article they're proposing, can you critique this, and so on. Well, I was one of the people he contacted, even though I was no longer on the Sierra Club's grazing team. I'd already left a couple of years earlier. But he nevertheless asked me to take a look at it and see if I could find any mistakes in it or whatever. And so I did start reading this, and I couldn't find anything wrong with the article itself, except that I thought the context was too narrow. So in other words, these guys had shown that if you had a piece of land, at least down in the southeastern part of the United States, it was in Georgia where they did their experiments, that if you grazed the land moderately, by their definition, that the soil would have a higher acquisition rate and higher total content of carbon and nitrogen than if you grazed the land heavily, again, by their definition, or if you just didn't graze it at all. And I couldn't find anything wrong with their methodology or their conclusions, but what I did find was that the way that their results were being promoted in the popular press, and popular press particularly the kind of agricultural journals that farmers and ranchers would tend to read, that it sounded like this type of grazing would actually help to reduce greenhouse gases that would mitigate global climate change. And if you actually look at it in that context, then their conclusions don't hold up, even though the original authors were not making that conclusion. But other people were at least insinuating that their approach would mitigate global climate change. So what I did in my critique was to put their research into the larger context of the environment, in which we'd look at the amount of methane that the cattle were themselves emitting in the course of the grazing that they did for the soil to absorb this additional carbon and nitrogen. And when I did that, I found that these cattle were, you know, emitting enormous amounts of methane that, in terms of the impact as a greenhouse gas, far outweighed any carbon that the soil was absorbing.
So, for instance, Mike, can you just tell our listeners a little bit about the difference in the carbon greenhouse gas? Sorry. Tell our listeners a little bit about the difference in the greenhouse gas potentials of carbon dioxide versus methane, just so they get an idea of how different it is.
Right. Yes, well, of course, everything is measured. All these different greenhouse gases are compared to carbon dioxide. But there's sort of a shorthand method that scientists have used over the years to compare the heat trapping ability of various greenhouse gases to carbon dioxide. It's something called global warming potential. And so it turns out that, like, for, you know, a given mass of methane compared to the same mass of carbon dioxide viewed over a particular time interval, and usually those time intervals are looked at as 100 years, but methane has a relatively short lifetime. It breaks down in the atmosphere due to solar radiation. And so a 100-year interval is probably not the best interval to use for methane because it's pretty much turned into carbon dioxide and other things after about a dozen years. But the 100-year interval is what it typically is used in many of the international reports. And so, I don't know, I think for 100 years, the so-called global warming potential of methane is like 34 times that of carbon dioxide. For a more realistic interval for methane, because of its relatively short life, usually 20 years is used. I think the global warming potential is something like 84 times that of carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. And so I actually did my calculations doing both of those intervals, and both of them showed that there was no overall advantage to the cattle grazing when you take the methane emitted by the cattle into account.
Jeez. Yeah, that's an incredible amount of greenhouse gases. And when you think about the effort that the Sierra Club and other groups in, you know, recently we heard about a huge effort by Bloomberg to, you know, totally obliterate the coal-powered electric sector, you know, and giving $500 million to do this, it seems like, you know, that's not going to be enough if we're going to continue with these grazing practices that are emitting as much as you said, just in the amount in the southeast of 54 coal-fired power plants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, actually the reality is much worse than this, right? Because I mean, these guys who did this research were getting this finding for what they called moderate grazing, which was less than 6 animals per hectare.
And only part of the year. And only part of the year,
and,
right?
And only part of the year. And so, I mean, what really is going on is probably much heavier grazing than that, mm-hmm. Typically. Yeah. So this would actually be sort of an improvement, right, from the environmental point of view. But it just shows how bad even that it would be.
How do you think we can get this information out to the public better so they can understand how devastating in a time when everyone's starting to become very aware of climate change and how diet impacts? It seems like if these numbers could be made available to the public in a more digestible manner, it would really help bring the issue to light.
Right. Yeah, I'm really not sure.
Well, one thing they could do is go to your website, right?
Well, they can do that. Yes, they can do that. I don't know how many people are going to sit through my video, which is, you know, like 23 minutes long. And that sort of gets us to the video. Like, why did I do that? Well, I had become very impressed over the years with Michael Greger's Nutrition Facts videos.
Oh, yeah.
Those
are
great.
And I thought, geez, that would be sort of interesting format to try for this article that I wrote. And I actually started working on that before I even finished the first version of the written essay back in 2015. And then I dropped it for about a year and a half and didn't start working on it again until January of 2017. But I thought, you know, it would be interesting to see whether this will get more attention than the original article. And that sort of remains to be seen. In the couple of months that I've had this up on YouTube, it's gotten almost 300 viewings, which for YouTube isn't much, but for my videos, considering that I've had some videos on YouTube that I did 7 or 8 years ago of interviews with ranching professionals and activists, have gotten fewer viewings than that.
Yeah.
And I've gotten you know, that many viewings in 2 months. So at least somebody's looking at it.
Yeah, and attractions.
And at the end of the day, if all, you know, the quickest and best way that we can all try to fight climate change in this climate crisis is to just change our diet, and
you know,
the quickest results just through those simple measures every day through what you eat.
Right. Yes. Well, I'm very hopeful now with all these meat substitutes that are coming out. The, you know, the Beyond Meat products and the Impossible Burger and a lot of the other ones. That may really have more potential to change people's diets than detailed information like this, especially if those products become more competitively priced.
We've been talking with Mike Hudak, environmental activist and author of Western Turf Wars. Let me try that again. We've been talking with Mike Hudak, environmental activist and author of many articles in Western Turf Wars. Mike, can you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about your work?
Yeah, sure. I have a website called MikeHudak.com, MikeHudak.com. And I have videos there and various essays and what I call photo essays, which show the impacts of impacts that cattle make on public lands, as we spoke about just a while ago. And also it has links to the website that has my book, both for sale and even free viewing at this point. So you can actually read the entire book as a PDF on that website at no charge.
Well, great. Well, thanks, Mike, and thanks for all that you're doing to help educate the public about what we can do in the face of a changing climate.
Okay, appreciate the opportunity to speak with you about it.